Hello and welcome to the Critical Ecologies podcast. This is a series of interviews with MA students in the Department of Geography in Maynooth, and these students have all taken a module in spatial justice. So we basically have a little bit of a chat about some of the research they've done for a core essay in the module. So today we have Karen Coyle, who is going to talk to us about her work on bogs and biodiversity and community and multi-species justice and spatial justice, of course. So lots to get talking about. But maybe, Karen, do you want to start by saying a little bit about yourself and your background and how you got interested in the topics?
Yeah, of course. I'm doing the MA in spatial justice. I did my undergrad in Maynooth as well in geography and sociology, and really enjoyed geography, really enjoyed all the different modules, enjoyed both physical and human geography. Probably in some of the modules in geography, we would have looked at bogs and what happened to them historically, how they're seen today. And that kind of sparked my interest a bit, especially towards the species decline that's happened around bogs. As well, maybe kind of linking in with where I live at the time, there was a lot of construction happening, a lot of new homes being built, and we had a lot of kind of activist groups fighting at the time to save a lot of trees and a lot of green areas where I live, which would have been home to a lot of kind of badgers, fox, rabbits, things like that. So that kind of interested me as well, was trying to have a voice maybe for keeping some of the green spaces that we had, because a lot of them were just being destroyed. And afterwards, you know, when a lot of the planning, a lot of the developers got planning permission for homes, and you know, which was needed, I know, in the area, and obviously Dublin does need homes, but it was the disregard, I suppose, for like trees and green spaces that have been there for like hundreds of years, you know, where I live, which is in Clonsilla in Dublin 15. So we're quite close to the Meath border. So there would have been a lot of green spaces, and it was just the disregard that, you know, there was no kind of consideration for trying to maybe keep some of the green spaces, or trying to keep, you know, some of the trees there that have been there for like centuries, really. And afterwards then, seeing how the developers, seeing what kind of came to fruition, and there was actually in a lot of times no need to kind of get rid of a lot of the green spaces that were there. You know, there's kind of nothing on a lot of those spaces now, although the houses are kind of built around. They could have been maybe worked into the development. So I don't know, I think I kind of have an interest maybe in just a balance between development and urbanization, but also for keeping our green spaces and trying to protect our native animals and species and trees and stuff like that.
Yeah, thanks. I'm always interested in the kind of background hearing a bit about that. So I guess it relates a little bit to the next question, which is about spatial justice and your understanding of spatial justice. Because in the essay, you make the point that its sort of origins are in urban contexts. And I know, you know, we looked at the work of Ed Soja and Henri Lefebvre and people like that. But your, you know, what you've just described there is obviously kind of suburban, getting out of the city. And then with the bogs, it's even more kind of rural contexts or the countryside. So maybe you could say a little bit about that.
I suppose kind of when we were doing the Right to the City and looking at Soja's work and kind of looking at it in an urban context, and how, you know, people who live in urban spaces and people who live in kind of built up areas should have equal rights to the resources there, and should have a say in what happens in the area around them, because it's, you know, it's where they live, they experience these spaces every day, so it's, you know, it affects every part of their life. So I kind of think I think that should relate, in my opinion, to no matter where you live or and not just to humans. I think it should relate to all species, that we all have a right to the spaces that we inhabit. We all have a right to kind of being considered when things are being planned for where we live. I don't think it should be just for an urban context. Like where I live now, my dad grew up, so he's kind of been living here like 75, 80 years. So he would have seen, when he was younger, it would have been a very rural area. You know, he would have worked on farms around here. And I think people who were lived closer to Dublin City would have classed Clonsilla, Blanderstown as kind of, that's the countryside, you know, because we were so close to Meath. So he's seen a lot of change around here. And I think if you live somewhere, and obviously if you live somewhere, you experience it every day and it affects all parts of your life, so whether it's in a city or in a suburb outside a city, or whether you're somewhere really rural like Leitrim, I think we all should have a right to saying what happens there, and maybe having some kind of involvement in decisions that are made for where we live. And I think it should be the same for all species. I don't think it should be just for humans. I think all species should be considered in that. So that's kind of where the spatial justice came into it for me.
Yeah, no, it's a nice way of putting it, and very kind of concrete. And I guess the bit that you were getting at there about the multi-species, or that, you know, other species, not just humans, you know, that reside in an area should have some kind of role or should be able to. So that's, I think that's possibly, you know, more novel or more radical in some ways.
Yeah.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about that and this concept of multi-species justice that you use in your essay.
Yeah. So I kind of used it in the essay in relation to more so the bogs, and considering how much species decline we've seen in bogs over the years due to their how they've been, you know, exploited and degraded and drained. And it was just kind of a concept that you had mentioned, Patrick, and I'd kind of looked into it a bit. And there's a lot of different kind of arguments for it, and a lot of different people have written on it. One of the papers I read was The Promise of Multi-Species Justice, which was edited by Sophie Chow and two other writers. And it was just reading that and kind of how they were saying that, you know, we need to think beyond just justice for humans now. Like, it's a concept that's described as a way of reconceptualizing justice to include beings beyond the human realm. That, you know, especially I think in the world we're living in today with the climate challenges that we have, that, you know, it should be a consideration when we're making decisions and making plans that all species are included in it. I also read, I didn't read the whole book, but there's a book by Donna Haraway called When Species Meet. And she kind of as well kind of advocates for thinking of humans and animals as separate is no longer relevant in our world today, that we need to kind of redevelop new ways of thinking about our relationship with other species. And not only that, but our kind of our responsibility to realize and what we've done, you know, as humans, the human activity that we've kind of engaged in over like the last couple of hundred years, how that's affected species. So yeah, it's kind of just thinking of it in a way that includes all living things. And it's not just like animals and birds, fish, it's like rivers, and our whole environment is kind of included in that. She also kind of, Donna Haraway kind of advocates for thinking about the legal and ethical frameworks that rule our relationships with other species and animals, and how unjust they are. You know, how we're such a human dominated society now that we need to take into account the needs and the interests of all different living things, especially when they can contribute so much to our biodiversity, our kind of our food security, just things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, certainly that idea of interdependency.
Yeah.
Is becoming so evident, you know, with the kind of biodiversity crisis and also the climate crisis. I think it's a really interesting area, and I know there's work around the rights of nature as well, including in Ireland, which is the kind of legal framework and legal discourses around the rights, you know, of rivers, for example. And I think, you know, and you might talk about this now with the bogs, but obviously in Ireland historically there have been different kinds of legal and certainly ethical relations to land and to nature, which, you know, sees them as sort of sacred or sees them as elevated beyond just a resource or something kind of inert. So there's lots, I think, to tap into there. But it makes sense anyway that you're drawing on these ideas, spatial justice and multi-species justice, to think about the bogs, because they're such wonderful ecologies and kind of landscapes. But I guess historically that hasn't always been the way in which they've been seen. So maybe you just want to say a little bit about bogs, because for most people, I'm guessing, you know, they don't know a lot about what bogs are and why they are so special and what the history of development on bogs and sort of overuse and exploitation of bogs has been. So
And I definitely would have been one of those people who would have thought, like, it's just a bog, especially as not having experienced bogs growing up, maybe, or been a part of my life in any way, until obviously going to college and kind of learning about them and doing work on them in modules and kind of just getting educated on what they are exactly. And they're so unique, like they're such unique places, and they provide homes to so many animals and birds and insects that can only live in those kind of wetlands. So they're really special places, and they can have such biodiversity. But of course they weren't always seen like that. Like, they've always kind of had this, even I suppose starting when we were ruled by Britain, you know, when we were colonized, that they were seen as kind of wastelands and just wasted spaces that weren't providing any sort of benefit to society or any sort of maybe economic benefit to governments or, you know, something like that. So historically they've been seen as kind of places that need to be maybe controlled or places that need to be changed in order to so they can provide some sort of benefit to us, whether that's agriculturally or extracting the peat from them to, you know, fuel our power stations in the Midlands. Like when we obviously gained our independence from Britain, and bogs had gone through, you know, a lot of drainage by that time, you know, to be used as agricultural land. But then obviously the extraction of peat was a target of the Irish government, the newly formed Irish government, so that we could reduce our reliance on Britain for their coal. We used to import their coal to for electricity and to as a fuel source. So the Irish government wanted to reduce that. So they kind of started industrial scale extraction of peat in the Midlands and built power stations. And that kind of really, really drastically affected the boglands that we had and the amount of them that we had, which then in turn, of course, when the boglands were drained and when they were extracted from, and, you know, intensive kind of agriculture that happened, it really affected the species that could call it home, because it didn't become a viable habitat then for them to live in. So we've seen a big species decline, especially of the wader birds, like the curlew, the red grouse, over maybe 50 years, the species declined dramatically. Now, like, they're both, I think, facing extinction. So it's just been historically, when you have a place that's kind of identified by governments as a wasteland and a place that needs to be benefit, you know, changed in order that we can benefit from it in a way that they see fit, usually around profit. It affects it drastically, and then the communities pay around it, and then also the species pay, you know, who call this place home, because it's no longer a habitat that they can live in, a place that they can thrive and survive.
Yeah, that's really well put. And I think, you know, the other dimension of it, and it's often harder to get at, so I don't know if you want to speak to it or not, but, you know, there were other human uses of the bogs, and this goes back, you know, thousands of years from the, you know, we can see from the kind of the archaeological record, but, you know, even in more recent times, that they're used for a kind of a smaller scale energy use, what you might call kind of subsistence or commons-based kind of economies. Yeah. And also, I heard a lovely story the other day of how it was kind of common practice that people who maybe farmed on the edges of bogs, if their animals were sick, they would let them graze on the bogs.
Okay.
Because there was all sorts of plants that grew there, and the animals themselves often knew which plants they maybe needed, and that they had these kind of medicinal properties. And so even though, so there's a way in which, like, you know, bogs being used for energy and bogs being used for agriculture, it can be done in a way that is, you know, less large scale and less, you know, dominated by these kinds of efforts to completely discipline the bog, I guess, and to kind of drain the bogs in a very large scale way. And I think that that's important to say too, that, you know, it's not all bad.
And I think especially, like you were saying, the subsistence, using the peat as a fuel source for so many homes, and like my partner, his family are from around Longford, and they still, you know, have their piece of bog that his granny uses, and, you know, that's a huge part of her, if you spoke to her about it, like, it's a huge part of her life, it's a huge part of her culture, her memories, you know, it came down through her the generations before her, and it can be very difficult for people of her age, or even, you know, anyone who's been used to having that in their life, to kind of have it to be cut dramatically all of a sudden. It's a big change, and it can affect them quite negatively in a lot of ways, not just as a fuel source, but it can also be a kind of a social outlet for a lot of people who live in really remote areas, having access to the part of the bog.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, maybe we could fast forward then to the present, because you gave that kind of history of mid 20th century sort of, you know, state development and the kind of large scale draining of the bogs and the use for kind of power generation, which then has left us with these, you know, very degraded, drained bogs today. So, and that's largely in the Midlands. So maybe you could just say a little bit about, you know, what the situation is now, what Bord na Mauna, which is the semi-state company responsible for the bogs, what it's trying to do, and also this idea of just transition and how that kind of fits within all that.
Yeah, well, Bord na Mauna now are, because obviously they're moving away from peat extraction and, you know, I suppose moving to different, they're trying to move now, or they have moved now, to kind of promoting themselves as a kind of a renewable energy company. And they're now kind of working towards, or working in around, wind energy and establishing wind farms on a lot of bog areas in the Midlands, which I think has kind of questionable, I don't know, it's like, obviously wind energy is something that, you know, the government needs to kind of invest in, and needs, you know, to invest in order to meet our climate targets that have been set for us. And obviously, as an island in the Atlantic, you know, it's something that we can benefit from, but it's where the wind farms are now and where they're being situated and the effects that they're having on the environments that they're in. a lot of blanket bogs and upland blanket bogs are seen as really kind of really good areas for producing wind energy, but they're also very sensitive areas to wind farm development. They can really negatively suffer from large-scale wind farm development because, you know, roads need to be constructed when they're building these wind farms. Soil needs to be drained. The soil is really disrupted for power cables, electricity pylons. So the installation of wind farms is really damaging for upland blanket bogs in particular. And that can then have an effect on the animals and the environments here. It can further impact species loss, but it can also impact the communities who live around these places. But I know there was a report recently put out, and the CEO of Borden Amona said, you know, the best places for wind farms are in these remote rural areas. But I think it's kind of a thought that just because they're remote and rural, that nobody will mind or nobody will be affected. But yet, you know, they're having huge impacts on areas. They're having huge impacts on the soil, especially soil erosion, which can be really affected by the installation of the wind farms. It can also affect if you have if there's an upland blanket bog that's active and is still and is actually sequestering carbon from the atmosphere and holding it in, it can really disrupt that, and it can actually end up in releasing the carbon from the soil. So you kind of have this contradiction where you're putting a wind farm in to obviously increase the wind energy and a renewable energy source, but you're also affecting the environment around that and actually possibly releasing carbon into the atmosphere. Borden Amona have also been kind of criticized about their just transition program and what that actually means for the workers at Borden Amona, who've kind of been left now unemployed. So the just transition it's actually a framework that was developed to try and help workers' rights and livelihoods who are going to be impacted by kind of government's moves and our moves as kind of a society towards sustainable climate change kind of methods now. And in the Midlands, Borden Amona have kind of promised to reinvest in communities and in workers who have been, who have lost their jobs from the from Borden Amona stopping the peat production. But it's kind of been questioned over the last few years as to their actual promise to the employers, or to the employees, should I say, because there's actually a councillor who came out in Offaly, and he said that Borden Amona aren't, when they install these wind farms for the renewable energy, they don't really need a workforce. A lot of the machines and a lot of the systems that they have in place are actual, you know, they don't need people there to work them. So they're not really providing jobs or the kind of employment opportunities that, say, the Midlands saw from Borden Amona maybe 50 or 60 years ago now, that they don't think that's going to happen again. They think that the jobs that Borden Amona are offering now are just jobs that will actually delay. It's just delaying by a few years redundancy for these people, because they're the kind of jobs where they've been brought in to maybe help restore bogs in some areas or use their expertise to help maybe rehabilitate certain parts, but they're not long-term jobs that can provide or even attract more people to these areas. That it's not really a sufficient just transition that what Borden Amona are offering. But I think Borden Amona now are like €1 billion company, so it's kind of I don't know. I just don't see how they're going to provide the kind of employment opportunities that they did, say, in the 50s or 60s to these areas, especially as these areas have been historically kind of under-resourced in and under-invested in by the government. So,
Yeah, I mean, that's, you've covered loads there, including that, there's some contradictions there in terms of, or maybe not contradictions, but, important to flag that those blanket bogs or upland bogs that you were referring to is not necessarily on land owned by Bord na Mona or wind farms developed by Bord na Mona, but they're more along the kind of west coast, often actually owned by Cuilce, another semi-state. Mm-hmm. But those are living bogs in many cases, whereas the wind farms that Bord na Mona are building in the Midlands are on, as you said, these kind of drained bogs. And I think there's also questions there about the rewetting of them and the extent to which the rewetting and restoration or rehabilitation of some of those drained bogs can happen while there are wind farms built on them, because it's not clear how these kinds of very large infrastructures can coexist with rewetted bogs, so again, it comes back to this point you were saying earlier of, there's been such a long history of bogs are only productive insofar as they're drained, basically. Mm-hmm. Whereas what you're saying is the kind of, to make them flourishing, sort of biodiverse, sort of, rich habitats and so on, they need to be rewetted. I mean, they're not bogs, if they're not watery, they're wetlands. But I mean, maybe that this is because I know we're running out of time a little bit, but to move on to the work of the Community Wetlands Forum, which is a kind of a more hopeful story and a hopeful project in the kind of work that they're doing around bog restoration. And maybe you could say a little bit about them and how that fits within multi-species justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're like the Community Wetlands Forum. They aim to provide a platform for community-led wetland conservation groups. And they are based on the principles of community development, which is empowerment, participation, inclusion, self-determination, and partnership. And they're like a group who are open to communities and kind of like projects or ideas that are at different stages of wetland promotion and protection. So like they might work with groups that have like basic kind of ideas on how to protect maybe their local wetland, to other groups who like are really kind of advanced in protecting and managing, their own sites as well of wetlands, and kind of really increasing their biodiversity and their value as a resource to the community. So I kind of really liked their ethos and their ideas and their aims, because it's kind of like based on connecting people but connecting people's knowledge as well. So a lot of people will have their own local knowledge to their specific wetland area or their bog, and they'll know the history of it, and it's kind of connecting people with all different sorts of knowledge and at all different sorts of levels to kind of learn from each other, and to protect the wetlands, basically, but also through promoting conservation and biodiversity. So protecting the species as well. So it's kind of like a holistic sort of approach. It's for the people who live in the area, but it's also for the animals and the plants and the insects and everyone really who can benefit from the restoration of wetlands.
Yeah, and I think it's also about bringing people and nature together, mm-hmm. and seeing how they can coexist.
Yeah,
in ways that are kind of mutually
supportive,
because it's also that, like you say, there's the projects that they can be for recreation and amenity, but there's also possibilities for like ecotourism or small things like that, which are not, again, these kind of large scale, projects that are going to, generate large financial revenue. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But that hopefully communities can benefit from it as well, in some way as well.
Well, that's been really great chatting to you about this. And the last question I had was about what you kind of take away from this research, I guess, and maybe the multi-species justice idea, maybe the bogs, you know, the focus on the bogs, and what you might take away with you now that the course is finished, whether that's in terms of like imagining, you know, future research, or whether that's in terms of like your newfound appreciation of bogs, or, you know, something that you might, yeah, so leave it open to you.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a little bit of everything. It's a new kind of an understanding I have now of how unique bogs are, like how amazing they are as a place, how much wildlife they support, how important that is for our biodiversity. But also like as a historic part of our culture and our heritage, how important they are as well. Like I would love to in some way, maybe when, you know, everything is done, maybe get involved some way in, we don't have any bogs around now where I live, but I know there are some that aren't too far away, but in some sort of conservation around maybe the birds that are really being threatened at the minute, that would be something that would interest me, that I'd love to maybe get involved in. And it's also about, but not just considering it for bogs, considering like multi-species justice for, I think, every area that we live in, whether it's urban or whether it's rural or remote or whatever, that it's something that I think everyone should be kind of aware of now and considering and thinking of, you know, as we move forward. I think, you know, maybe we need to be a voice for animals that are being threatened or species that are in decline now. And I kind of had only really seen that through looking at the what's happened to bogs over the years and the threats now to the biodiversity there. But it's kind of a bit of everything, appreciation for the bogs, for the species, but also bringing that into, you know, where we live, what's around us in our environment, that we can be aware of, kind of looking out for animals as well around where we live. It doesn't have to be in a rural context or, you know, somewhere where animals are really threatened. We can kind of do little bits to help species, I think, in all our environments, no matter where we live. I think it's something that we should all consider.
Well, that's a great way to finish, and I would agree. So thanks, Karen, for sharing all your thoughts and your work with us. And I hope you do go on to do, maybe get in touch with the Community Wetlands Forum too. Yeah. I'm sure that they'd be interested to hear from you.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay, thanks, well, for Patrick. Now, thanks a million.
Okay, no problem.
That was great.